We'll move past it today, but in the last two programs we have ended with and then have focused on Galatians 1:6. Paul wrote, "I marvel that in this way quickly you change, desert, and depart, becoming disloyal apostates, away from the calling in the name of grace to a different healing message and beneficial messenger." The statements that we were analyzing here, we talked first about the fact that if you were actually inspired by God, if you read his testimony, you don't have to have a direct line to him in the sense of prophetic visions. Just read his testimony. You don't wonder about what's going to happen. You know. I know what the future holds. So does every member of the covenant family. Because Yahweh's told us. We're not surprised. Second, the benefits of Yahweh's teaching endure. There is no one ever in the history of humankind who has come to know Yahweh, who has studied his Torah, who has, by closely examining and carefully considering, the Hebrew word is observe, which means it's actually shama, the shamar. Shama is to listen, shamar is to observe in Hebrew. The instructions that God has provided relative to his covenant and to the means to disengage from our world and enter his home. Every one of us who knows these things is forever a member of his family. We never change. I will grow. I will never change. And that is true of every member of the covenant family. We're profoundly influenced by our Heavenly Father, but we never change. So the message that Paul communicated to them could not have been the message that Yahweh himself authored in the Torah, guiding us to participate in his covenant. Third, by using the Greek terms that he has selected, Paul is speaking of a mutiny. He is criticizing the Galatians because they have turned on him. This became personal. The Galatians' disloyalty was being directed at Paul himself, because he saw himself as the founder of a new religion. He considered these traitors to be apostates, which is a term used in conjunction with religion. Fourth, by using kallio, Paul, which is the Greek word for name, Paulus has now affirmed that he was using charis, the Greek name of the charities, which are the gratia, which became grace in English. It's a name. He's affirming that he's using it as a name, not as a verb, not as an idea, but as a name. And while these girls were alluring, they were also mythological. Yahweh does not call us to false gods, even when they're really cute. And fifth, by saying that the Galatians had embraced a different euangelion, a different healing message and beneficial messenger. Euangelion is based on you, which means beneficial, healing. And agelos, which means messenger, which is then extrapolated to message. What are we to make of Paul and his competition? I mean, the only people that Paul acknowledges that he was in opposition to, not only in this letter, but in the letters that he wrote to Timothy, are Yosha's disciples, in particular Shimon Kephesh, Peter, Yohanan, John, and Jacob, known as James. That's his competition. How in the world can you be speaking for God if those that God chose to speak for him are in opposition to what you have to say? Having studied Shaul's initial letters, I've come to the conclusion that he never provided his audience with a sufficient number of appropriate Torah, prophets, and Psalms references for them to understand Yahweh's plan of salvation. I can say that with absolute certainty. His style was to issue a wide range of unsupported opinions under the banner, "But I say." So rather than deliver the information that any person would actually need to know Yahweh and to have reasons to trust him, Shaul, Paul, asked the faithful to believe him. He even encouraged them to imitate him. That's the Quran approach. The Quran says that Muhammad's the best example to follow. But Paul, like Muhammad, was a sexual pervert, a liar. And like Muhammad, Paul, by his own admission, was demon-possessed. The other reason that Paul had so much trouble with his first three assemblies, the Galatians, the Thessalonians, and the Corinthians, is that his message to Galatia, Thessalonica, and Corinth was radically different than Yahweh's. Radically different than Yahusha's. Completely opposed to the disciples. And since the overwhelming preponderance of the first to capitalize upon Yahweh's teaching were Yehudim, more commonly known as Jews today, they not only knew the Torah, they had come to recognize Yahusha by way of the Torah, just as he instructed all of us and everyone that he encountered. And they realized that Paul lacked the authorization to annul any part of it. The only person that could have potentially been authorized to annul the Torah, affirm the Torah, that would be Yahusha. And Yahusha said, "Do not think that I have come to annul the Torah. I have come to affirm it, to fulfill it, to honor it." So this became a credibility issue, you might say. They could trust Yahweh or believe Paul. And initially, based upon the evidence contained in the first five epistles to the Galatians, Thessalonians, the Corinthians, the people who actually met with Paul, who listened to his preaching overwhelmingly, preferred the testimony of Yahweh to Paul. In fact, considering Paul's desperate admission to Timothy, for a while, all of Asia rejected Paul. All of it. You know, Asia would be what's considered Turkey today. Paul's birthplace, the place where we're dealing with the Galatians, where they lived. You know this, that those in Asia have turned away from me. 2 Timothy 1:15. What did they recognize that Christians are ignoring today? Galatians 1:6 is enlightening in this regard. It states that there were two competing euangelion, healing messengers and beneficial messages. Obviously, one of the messages and messengers was Paul. As we have made our way through his initial letter, we will know him and it extremely well, and that becomes obvious. But then, who were or is his competitor or competitors? Our options are Yahweh and his Torah, which Paul has already dismissed as being egregious, as being pornography, as being enslaving, as being incompetent, as being repudiated. Yahusha, who is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, and therefore literally the mouth of Yahweh, the hand of Yahweh. So that makes them one and the same. And that same Torah, out of which pages Yahusha walked, or one or more of the disciples, namely Shimon Kefesh, Yaukanan, Jacob. But their message was the same as Yahweh's, which was the same as Yahusha's, which was the same as the Torah. So it goes right back to the same thing we talked about in the first hour about the video. One of these things is not the same. We have total harmony. The Torah, Yahweh, the prophets, Yahusha, all in complete harmony, all with exactly the same message, without variation. And then you have Paul with an entirely different message that repudiates the message of Yahweh, Yahusha, the Torah, the prophets. Which of these is out of sync? Which of these is not like the other things? The answer, of course, is obvious. It's clear. It's undeniable. Well, that's just the way it is. The only competitor to Paul was God himself. And perhaps that's why Paul spoke of their calling in the name of grace, not in the name of Yahweh. The graces were cuter, at least from Paul's perspective. More alluring, sexier, more now and today, more Roman, more Greek, more universal in their appeal, happier from Paul's perspective. One of the reasons our options are so constrained is because the challenger was said to be wielding a different euangelion, healing messenger and beneficial message. Therefore, Paulus's foe can neither be Judaism nor Rome. At this place and time, they were the antithesis of healing and beneficial. Moreover, in his subsequent letters and in Acts, Paul will actually speak glowingly about both Judaism and about Rome, even the Roman government, telling everyone that listens to him that they must submit to the Roman government, and that he was a star within the circles of rabbinic Judaism. And that eliminates them as adversarial candidates. Reinforcing this conclusion, Yahusha denounced Judaism as it was practiced in the day, as it's practiced today as well. And he was convicted by Rome. So they cannot be considered beneficial or healing. We're back to one choice. It was Paul versus God. The answer to the question of who was competing against Paul, that which beneficial messenger and healing message that the Galatians preferred to what Paul was offering, is that it's the united front of the Torah, of its author, Yahweh, of the prophets who spoke for God, and Yahusha, who is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, as well as the disciples who spoke for him as they were trained by him. That's who Paul was competing against. They all had exactly the same message. Yahusha, the disciples, the Torah, the prophets, and Yahweh. And it was Paul who offered a different message. Now, I know that Christians will say, no, it was the daggone Judaizers. There's no such thing as a Judaizer. It's a fictitious concept. The truth is that not only didn't Jews ever evangelize. Now, Jews have never cared if you convert to Judaism or not. They really have. Means nothing to them. Now, if you're a Jew, and most Jews are secular, by the way, the overwhelming preponderance of Jews are secular. A very tiny percentage of Jews are actually religious Jews. Most Jews are Jews by ethnicity, not by religion. And it is true that religious Jews will sometimes try to encourage secular Jews to be more religious, and it's only because they want their money and they want their loyalty and they want the power that comes from that. They want the control that comes from it. But you will very seldom find, and maybe can't find, a rabbi whose job it is, whose mission it is, to convert people to Judaism. They weren't Judaism. They weren't Judaizers. The whole concept is bogus. Never happened in human history. Never. So there wasn't anybody trying to get people to be Jewish ethnically, because that's impossible. And there was no one that was trying to get the tiny section or cross-section of Jews who are engaged in Judaism to be to engage in the religion. It's just not possible. I'd say one of those twisted Christian justifications to hide the fact that Paul's only adversary was God himself and everyone who represented Yahweh. The answer is obvious. The reason that it isn't seen as such is because of Paul's approach. By claiming to speak on behalf of the individual and message he is opposing and against the spirit he is promoting, to discover the truth, a person has to compare Yahweh's actual testimony to Paul's letters. But by disparaging Yahweh's revelation and by ignoring Yahusha's testimony, Paul never cites him. Those who are swayed by Paul are predisposed to discard this evidence against him. So, long as the audience remains religious, operating in the realm of faith, Paul's scheme prevails. To understand who is opposing whom, we have to be willing to examine the evidence, to process it judgmentally, and to be receptive to the truth. To be open to the truth. In reality, Paul defined his foe in the first sentence of his first letter. He wrote that we are being plucked away from the counterproductive and laborious old system accurately known as the Torah. If it wasn't his enemy, Poneros would never have been deployed to demean what he is inferring is the Old Testament. So now in the second sentence, Paulos is distinguishing his approach from God's. And he's calling the Galatians apostates for rejecting what he had to say and instead accepting what God had to say. He is showing his bewilderment and his frustration that those he spoke to in Galatia prefer that old God to his new scheme. Had it not been for two clever tricks, the obvious answer would have become apparent to most everyone centuries ago, just as it was evident to those who actually listened to Paul in Galatia, in Corinth, and Thessalonica, as well as those in Rome and Asia. The first of these clever ploys or tricks is that by pretending to speak for God, by pretending to be a brother, Shaul became the wolf in sheep's clothing. He is seen for other than what he is. He was accepted and viewed as being one with them, while he was in fact devouring them. That's why Yahusha in the Sermon on the Mount, in his first public declaration, warned us about the sheep, the wolf in sheep's clothing, who would oppose the Torah. In the most telling prophecy for our time that I've ever read. And there's a lot of telling prophecy for our time. I mean, Yahweh spoke directly of the Syrian civil war, for example. Told us exactly when it would occur, why it would occur, who the belligerents were, what the outcome was going to be. Told us how the United States was going to play a leading and negative role in it. What it was going to lead to. I mean, Yahweh's got some really gripping prophecies of what we are enduring right now at this moment. But to my personal affinity, in terms of what I think is the most important prophecy of our time, it's buried in a very little known prophet. If I were to say Habakkuk, most people would have absolutely no idea of whom I was speaking. And no clue who Habakkuk is. It's actually in Hebrew, it's Chabauk. It means embrace this. And yet, exactly 666 years before Paul wrote his first letter, that's to the Galatians, Yahweh told us all about this man. And he told us that the big issue with Paul, who he named, called by name, Paul was, chose the Roman name, Paulos, which means lowly and little. He was born Shaul. And it specifically tells us that a man named Shaul would be the plague of death. It tells us when he was going to arrive on the scene, what he was going to do, and how he would deceive people. And then Yahweh has a play on words. He knows that Shaul means question him. And he says, so why is it that people don't question him? It's so obvious that this man is deceitful, that he's using circular reasoning, that no one who believes him will be satisfied. Why is it that no one questions him? But we've just discovered is obvious. There's only one candidate for Paul's competition with a different healing and beneficial message. Yahweh, God, Yahusha, the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, the Torah, the prophets. They all speak with one voice, and their voice is the antithesis of what Paul's saying. They are the competition. And so God says, with it being that obvious, why is it that no one questions him? You know, you've got the largest religion in the world today. Some 3 billion people that have been beguiled by this man. Now, some would say, in fact, you probably couldn't even post this on YouTube, that it's hate speech because I'm critical of the religion of Christianity, which is based entirely on Paul's letters. Paul is the founder of the religion of Christianity. His letters comprise half of the Christian New Testament. And they would say that by exposing and condemning the author of half the Christian New Testament, Paul, and the basis of the religion of Christianity, that I'm speaking hatefully. And yet, there's nothing that's more compassionate and loving. It would be hateful for me to recognize what Yahweh said, what God had to say about Paul was true, which I do. It would be hateful for me to be able to use evidence and reason to demonstrate conclusively that Paul was lying, which I have, and then not share it. To let billions of people go to their doom without a warning. Billions of people are going to die, beguiled by Paul, and have their souls cease to exist because they just don't know any better, because they were played for fools by the advocates of the Christian religion. That they were born a Catholic and they didn't have the good sense to question the religion and leave it. That they were born a Christian and they never bothered to question the author of their New Testament, or even question why there could be a New Testament, and how in the world could God inspire a plan that was contradictory to the plan that he had already inspired. Very few people are willing to examine the evidence and render an informed and rational decision. That's why the most important prophecy, I think, for our age is in Habakkuk 2. Where God specifically asks us, begs us, encourages us to question Paul, the most influential man who ever lived, calling him out by name, calling him the plague of death. That's why Shaul changed his name to Paul. It's why Yahweh warned us. It's why Yahusha, in his opening and most public and longest public declaration, the Sermon on the Mount, which Christians don't ever want to consider. They skip right past that baby because everything Yahusha said in the Sermon on the Mount destroys the religion. He spoke specifically of Paul when he talked about the wolf in sheep's clothing. Paul, the Benjamite, he constantly claims that he was a Benjamite. Yahweh says the Benjamite is the wolf. And then Paul admits in Corinthians of being a chameleon, being the wolf in sheep's clothing that is willing to pretend to be what he is not to earn the trust of those he's betraying. The wolf in sheep's clothing. He says, you know, to the Jew, I am a Jew. To the Greek, I'm a Greek. To those who observe the Torah, I pretend to observe the Torah. To those who are Torahless, I am also without the Torah. I do all things to gain an advantage. Paul's admitting that he is the wolf in sheep's clothing, who beguiled people into rejecting the Torah, which is the exact context that Yehoshua makes the point in the Sermon on the Mount. And yet, even though it's in their New Testament, even though it's cited and by Yehoshua himself, even though it precedes all of Paul's letters, there's not one Christian in a million that wants to grapple with that and understand the egregious difference, the irreconcilable difference between what Yehoshua said and did and what Paul said and wrote. You know, for example, Yehoshua was resolutely Torah observant. Paul was resolutely Torah averse. They could not be more dissimilar. One thing is not like the others. Now, the second ploy is found in the writing style. One blends circular reasoning with all manner of logical flaws with a myriad of inappropriate word choices and errant citations of evidence. The opening sentence is a prime example. Due diligence is required, as is thoughtful consideration, to understand why a violent verb, plucking away, tearing away, gouging out, was deployed against a pornographic and arcane scheme. But those who haven't been conditioned by their political, religious, academic, and media institutions to avoid being judgmental, even critical, read right through Paul's confession, and they're left wondering, but they don't really care. Before we move on, and with regard to Galatians 1:6, please note that Paul did not write gospel at the end of this sentence. There is no Greek word even remotely akin to gospel, just like there's no Greek word remotely akin to church. When you read church or cross or gospel in your Bible and identify these as the single most important terms relative to Christianity, every one of them is a fraud. There is no Greek basis whatsoever for gospel. There's no Greek basis for church. There's no Greek basis for cross. None. The word translated church is ecclesia. It's a translation of mikra, which are the invitations to meet with God. The word translated cross is staros. It means upright pole. It identifies itself with the edon of the Torah, which is the upright pillar set into the foundation of the temple of the witness. It's complete fabrications. And here, euangelion, which is translated gospel, gospel is a pagan term. It's God's spell. And euangelion actually speaks of a beneficial message and a healing messenger. But it's never translated that way. And therefore, Yahuconin's words are considered the gospel of John. Matanyah's testimony is considered the gospel according to Matthew. It's not true. They didn't have gospels. There's no word even remotely akin to that. And so it's the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, no gospel, no Jesus, no Christ. I mean, Christianity is nothing but a heap of lies, folks. I mean, if they've lied to you about everything, including the gospel, why do you trust them? Why are you willing to wage your soul on an institution and people that are so universally untrustworthy? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It's just brain dead. It's like to be religious, you have to absolutely stop thinking. You can't be observant, because if you are, the facts will destroy your faith. Well, euangelion is a compound of two very common Greek words. I've shared that with you. It's not a name. It's not a title. And if it were a name or a title, it should have been transliterated euangelion. That's what you do with names and titles. You transliterate them. Now, this is Greek. Paul wrote Greek, so you can transliterate it from Greek. If it was in Yosha's voice, you could not transliterate it because he spoke Hebrew. Now, euangelion is what was actually written in Jerome's Latin Vulgate. but not in any modern English translations. For example, in the King James, euangelion was neither translated nor transliterated, but instead the Greek word was replaced by the religious concept gospel. The King James conveys, I marvel that so soon removed from him that called you to the grace of Christ to another gospel. Now, not only does this have all sorts of words that aren't there, there is no grace of Christ. Paul didn't write anything remotely close to that. And they've forgotten the word name. But beyond all of this, it's Paul that is the one saying, you know, why did you leave? Why are you an apostate to what I said and choose this other plan? And this has it leaving Yahusha, his Christo, to another gospel as opposed to going back to the beneficial messenger, Yahusha and Yahweh, and therefore being an apostate to Pauline Christianity. We will consider the other translations as they all corrupt Paul's testimony, which they have to twist to maintain believers. We'll be back in a moment. Most of the time we can attribute the errors that we find in the King James to the Latin Vulgate. The Latin Vulgate was created to empower Catholicism. It was under Constantine that it was composed. And so typically we can find errors that we find in the King James there. Because for those that think that the King James was a authorized and inspired translation from the oldest Greek manuscripts and the oldest Hebrew manuscripts by godly men, it was written by Sir Francis Bacon. It was a revision of the Geneva Bible. It was authorized only in the extent that King Iams at the time, known to us as James, didn't like the fact that the footnotes in the Geneva Bible correctly pointed out that there is no mandate given by God for kings to rule over any people, much less in Great Britain. And so he wanted a translation that served his political interests. And the translation wasn't a translation. They simply revised the Geneva Bible to suit their purposes. And when they actually had to translate something, they did so by translating the Latin Vulgate. They were Latin scholars. They weren't Greek scholars. They didn't even have a reasonable copy of the Textus Receptus. And the Textus Receptus is a fraud in and of itself. The Textus Receptus is an absolute, total and complete academic and financial fraud. But they aren't translating it either. So King James is an absolute waste of time. And there's so many people say, oh, it's the absolute authorized and inspired word of God. And they're idiots. But typically you can find in the Latin Vulgate the basis for the King James. In this particular case, you won't. So the King James is now revising the Geneva Bible. It says, I wonder that you have been so quickly transferred from him who called you into the grace of Christi over to another evangelium. Now, while we can blame Jerome for the inclusion of Christi, which is errant on three accounts. If it's a word, it should have been translated implement doing the work of Yahweh, because it was Christus, not Christos, a very different word in Greek. And it was represented by a placeholder. If it's a title, a divine placeholder should have been transliterated Masayah, which is what the divine placeholder was representing. But according to Papyrus 46, which was written probably within 25 to 50 years of the time that Paul wrote this letter, and therefore is by far the oldest and most complete witness to it, Paul didn't actually include the divine title in this sentence, neither by placeholder nor by actually writing it out. So it was the name of grace of the Gratia that he wrote, he did not say it was the name or into the grace of Christi or Christ, which is what you read in your English Bibles. And so he was literally calling his believers to the name of the graces. And the Christian theologians recognized that that was a real problem because they were pagan goddesses. And so they added of Christi, of Christ, to make it the grace of Christ, so that they could beguile and therefore control and therefore fleece Christians. It's astonishing that such lies are perpetrated. And even if you were to look at the Nestle Allen, you know, it continues the error. The Nestle Allen claims, which is the most credible now, Greek, it's not really a manuscript, but it's a compilation of manuscripts. And it claims that it is now corrected to reflect the oldest known manuscripts of these letters. But they lie. They've got in the Nestle Allen, I marvel that thusly quickly you change from the one having called you in favor of Christ to another good message. But they know, those scholars, the ones that facilitated that interlinear that I just shared with you from the Nestle Allen, they know for fact that Christ is not in the oldest manuscript. And they promoted that same lie because if you remove the lie, at least with informed and rational people, the whole basis of Pauline Christianity crumbles because it's being promoted in the name of grace. Not in the name of Yahweh. Not in the name of Yahusha. Paul lied. And Christians, to promote their religion, perpetuated his lie.